We've lost about 120 jobs so far this year compared to the same period last year in the category of air transportation.
Dramatic declines in air cargo at Ted Stevens International Airport. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 28th of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the push to restore Alaska's only Haida Longhouse.
You see this huge structure standing there, and it's pretty awe-inspiring.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Cargo shipments in and out of Anchorage's Ted Stevens International Airport are down, and that's not helping as the city deals with a budget shortfall. APRN's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Asian-bound cargo planes are a familiar sight over the skies of Anchorage, but now a global economic slump is hitting Alaska's air freight hubs. Once one of the largest cargo transfer points in the U.S., Anchorage is beginning to feel the pinch.
We've also seen the ranking of Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport go from third in the world in 2007 for total volume going through the airport. It's now moved down to fifth position in the world.
Bill Popp is director of Anchorage's Economic Development Corporation.
You know, you've got a couple of things going on at the airport with declines in both passenger and freight volume. We've seen a marked decrease in passenger volume at Anchorage International. Based on their reports, it's down about 10% between January and May of this year compared to the same period in 2008. When it comes to cargo, that decrease has been more substantial. For the first 5 months of 2009, there has been a 35% reduction in the total weight of all air cargo moving through Anchorage International.
The slowdown in cargo is a direct reflection of the national and global recession. It has reduced the number of takeoffs and landings at Ted Stevens International. The airport is operated by the state of Alaska, and landing fees are paid to the state. But Anchorage feels the impact in cargo reductions in airport employment, Pop says.
We've lost about 120 jobs so far this year compared to the same period last year in the category of air transportation. That's inclusive of large carriers such as FedEx. It's not a dramatic decline, but it is still a noticeable decline in employment at the airport for the first 6 months of 2009.
Total tonnage being shipped through the port of Anchorage is down, too. A slowdown in the sale of new cars is partially to blame for the reduction in surface shipping, Pop says. Meanwhile, the Tacoma News Tribune reports that domestic shipments to Alaska from Seattle's SeaTac Airport are dropping, too. That means reduced income for cargo shipping companies like Linden Transport or Totem Ocean Trailer Express. On a brighter note, state economist Neil Fried says Alaska is not in bad shape compared to other states. Unemployment here is 8.4%, and that's below the national average.
When we compare ourselves with the same period a year ago, our employment is down slightly, but you know that's sort of the operative word. Our employment is down slightly, whereas the nation's employment is down, you know, very dramatically. You know, ours is down by less than 0.5%. Theirs is down by over 4%.
It seems a contradiction that cargo is down while new big box stores are moving to Anchorage. Fried hints at another new target coming in, too. But he says decisions made by national companies to locate in Anchorage were made years before the economic slump took hold.
But what's happening, both domestic and international cargo, is just simply a reflection, really, of the national and, you know, the international scope of this recession. I mean, it's a very broad recession.
But Pop says Anchorage, at least, is holding its own against a down economy.
So we have cargo coming through from China, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, and points in between. It's a very, very large volume of cargo coming through Anchorage International. And quite honestly, even with the downturn that we are currently facing, that business has been one of the reasons we have not felt as heavy of an impact from the national recession, just because of the jobs that that air cargo industry has created in the Anchorage economy over the last 10 years.
Pop plans to release new city economic figures on Wednesday. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
A new wind farm went into operation just outside of Nome at the end of last year, but local leaders are confronting a series of challenges in keeping the turbines spinning. From KNOM in Nome, Jesse Zink reports.
The wind farm on Banner Peak, just north of Nome, went up in about 6 months of construction last year, with financing from both the Bering Straits and Sitnasauk Native corporations. At the time, it was hailed as an example of what renewable energy could do for rural areas of the state. But the turbines were shut down at the end of May. Western Community Energy Project Manager Ian Graham says the problem was in Turbine 1.
We monitored the production and performance. The performance was starting to degrade, and we were starting to scratch our heads and look at all the systems. And then it decoupled, which means the generator had become decoupled from the drivetrain.
The same turbines have been used in Kotzebue for a decade. Graham says the problem was not Nome's weather, but a manufacturing defect in a large group of turbines.
It's really a batch issue and not a climate issue. Now, what happened in Nome is that the problem became more evident because we had higher wind loads. So it's easier to identify the problem, but the problem is really in that entire batch of turbines.
The turbines were manufactured by Integrity Wind, a Canadian company that has about 130 of its 50-kilowatt turbines in use around the world. When Graham spoke with Integrity about the problem, Integrity CEO Jim Heath told him to shut down all 18 turbines.
It wasn't a safety issue at all. It was simply a wear issue. And as a manufacturer, you want to, you know, make sure you start off right. Just for purposes of preventive maintenance, we shut it down. I thought that was a conservative approach. I actually think I ought to be applauded for that.
In order for the wind farm to restart, Integrity needs to produce a specialized part for the turbines. In the meantime, Heath has promised to reimburse Banner Wind for the revenue lost during the shutdown. But the wind industry has been hit hard by the economic slowdown, and Integrity has encountered serious financial problems. They've sent workers home and have been ordered by a provincial labor board in Canada to pay its employees months of back wages. Heath blames the federal stimulus bill for his company's troubles and says he's confident the company can meet all its obligations.
The market kind of stopped. Not so much, I don't think, because of the recession and the credit crisis, but more because of the announcement of the stimulus bill. And many, many, many of our customers, people that wanted equipment, decided they were going to wait for their stimulus money and they weren't using their own. So cash became very tight. We have been suffering a liquidity issue, but I don't think I have any issues with respect to the Banner project. My intention is to honor all of our obligations to the project.
The Prince Edward Island provincial government is currently exploring options to prop up the company until it can find additional financing. Heath says he's confident he can find the necessary cash in the next few weeks. But that still leaves 18 turbines shut down outside of Nome. Project manager Graham says his company is prepared to step in if Integrity can't do the job.
And if we come up against a time constraint, meaning we're running out of build season, we'll go out and reverse engineer and manufacture them third party. So there's a backup plan there to really get things re-engaged.
Banner Wind says it's hopeful the turbines will be spinning again before the snow flies in Nome. In the meantime, wind farm owners and Nome Joint Utility Service are still negotiating a power sales agreement to get the energy into Nome's transmission lines. In Nome, I'm Jesse Zink.
July is on track to be the hottest and driest in Fairbanks history. Only 4/100ths of an inch of rain has been measured in Fairbanks as of today. National Weather Service meteorologist Corey Freeman says a large high-pressure ridge has resulted in a stagnant air pattern over interior Alaska.
It's really steered all of the systems that have been carrying rain well to the west of Fairbanks. We've also had not a whole lot of thunderstorm activity, you know, around right in the local area, at least not that's fallen at the airport. And with the prospects of rain very slim for the rest of the week, it looks like this will go down as not only the driest July on record, but the driest summer month on record at Fairbanks.
There have been winter months in Fairbanks with no measurable precipitation, but Freeman says this month should best 1927 for the driest July and likely any June, July, or August in Fairbanks' recorded weather history. Freeman says July 2009 will also be one of the hottest.
so far this month, our average daily maximum temperature has been 78.6 degrees, and that ranks above July of 1915, when the average high was 78.4. So there's a good likelihood with temperatures 80 or above the next few days right through the end of the month, that this will end up as the warmest July on record and perhaps one of the top two or three warmest summer months ever on record in Fairbanks.
The extended spell of hot, dry conditions has allowed wildfires to spread across the interior. More than 1.6 million acres have burned so far. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Tlingit rapper tries to make it on the national stage.
I'm very dedicated, and even though I come from a small town, I'm not giving up, you know.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Alaska's only Haida Longhouse is in need of some serious repair. The wooden structure is near the community of Kasan on Prince of Wales Island, and as KRBD's Jay Marble reports, the village hopes to raise enough money to restore the historic site to its original condition.
The longhouse in Kasan was built, or perhaps more accurately, rebuilt in the 1930s as part of the Depression-era program known as the Civilian Conservation Corps, a kind of economic stimulus program of the times.
I've lived in Kasan pretty much the entirety of my life, and you know, I'm 33 years old, and to this day I get goosebumps when I walk and you come out of the forest trail and it opens up and you see this huge structure standing there, and it's pretty awe-inspiring.
Richard Peterson is the tribal president for the organized village of Kasan.
Yeah, I think the last event there was a memorial potlatch probably about 7 or 8 years ago, and it was pretty amazing. You know, Heidelberg dance groups performed in there, and, you know, to hear the drums and the singing and the dancing and the way that the sound just kind of reverberates in there, and looking and seeing the light kind of bounce off the faces of the totem poles, you know, and just, you know, it blows you away. It really does.
The clan house was actually originally built in the 1800s. That's a long time for any wooden structure in southeast Alaska to stand up to the elements. Not only is the longhouse in the rainforest, it's also close to the ocean with its strong winds. The walls are collapsing in some places. The roof, which has a large opening to let smoke out, is also worse for wear. For Peterson and many others, the longhouse and the totem poles, both on the inside and the outside and the surrounding trees, represent their cultural identity.
And it's such an important place to, you know, the Haida people and to those of us who live in Kasan, you know, it's been there my entire life, you know, so, and you go back there and it's removed enough from the community, remotely enough that it's like going through time when you walk back there.
Peterson says, according to an architect's estimate, it will take about $2.5 million to fully restore the longhouse. And Peterson says there is a plan being put together. The longhouse actually sits on Kavilko land, the local native corporation. Kavilko has set up the Kasan Haida Heritage Foundation. Peterson says that entity and the organized village of Kasan will aggressively pursue grants and look for philanthropic partners. It's a big job, but Peterson says maybe it could all come together in as little as 2 years. Then he says there will be a call out for Haida carvers.
We're going to focus on the building itself first, but yeah, there's some totem poles involved with that, and we want to do it as traditionally as possible as well. A lot of ads work.
I'm Jay Marble.
In preparation for the 100th anniversary of the Sitka National Historic Park, the Park Service is taking on a series of projects. A new totem pole has been commissioned, and the Park Service spent last week cleaning 17 other totems already on display outside the visitor center and along the trails. KCAW's Emily Schwing reports.
The Frog Raven Pole stands just behind the south corner of the Sitka National Historic Park Visitor Center. On the back of the pole, there is a number 2 and a 1-800 number visitors can dial on their cell phones to hear about the totem.
You are seeing a Kaigani Haida crest pole from Tlingit on South Prince of Wales Island.
But on this day, it might be kind of hard to hear that description because Park Service employees are out cleaning this and 16 other totem poles throughout the park. But that sound you're hearing isn't a power washer, It's just an electric genie lift operated by park ranger Tom Gamble.
And the 35-foot poles didn't seem very large until after we got into this little gate right here. When we locked the gate, started looking down the poles, to me, I've gained a newfound respect, not only for their height, but just their whole physical presence, and being able to see them from a different angle, I think, up close.
As a result of being on display outside in a temperate rainforest, the totem poles become virtual algae farms. If you look close, there's a thin, dark green film growing on most bare wood in the Tongass.
That's actually the more difficult thing to clean and get off.
That's Randy Rogers. He's in charge of maintenance for the park.
And then we also are picking out what are called the radial cracks, the large cracks that are in the totems that you see. Debris gets in those, which over a period of time it decomposes, and then it absorbs moisture. And if you're not careful, a seed can get in there, and you can actually get... We have pictures of totems that have trees growing out of them.
About every 3 years, Park Service maintenance crews clean and assess the poles as part of a preservation plan set up in the 1990s by a team of wood conservators from Harper's Ferry Center in West Virginia. Stephanie Stevens is the head curator for the National Park Service Alaska region. She came down from Anchorage to take part in the cleaning.
What Tom and I and the rest of the maintenance staff have been doing is going up, taking a look. If, in fact, we have some issues, some wood deterioration or so, we're noting that. And then we'll probably see about doing some project proposals in order to get some conservators out here to conserve those particular sections or pieces that need work.
Stevens is using a mild soap and soft bristle brushes to remove the slime and the growth from the frog raven pole. She's also applying a salt-based insect repellent called Boracare.
This particular pole that we're working on right now, it looks like it is going to need some additional care on the nose, the beak section. new nose job.
The totem poles were acquired in the early 1900s by Governor John G. Brady, Alaska's fifth territorial governor. After exhibiting the poles at the 1904 St. Louis World's Fair and the 1905 Lewis and Clark Exposition, Governor Brady sent them to Sitka. Over the years, some of the original totems have deteriorated. Those poles are preserved in the park's totem hall, and replicas now stand along the trail. Ranger Tom Gamble was born and raised in Sitka. He says this project is as much about preserving culture as it is about protecting art.
Well, the totems themselves are a real big attraction for visitors and locals alike, and I think that will remain throughout the history of the park, no matter how many generations pass through here.
In Sitka, I'm Emily Schwing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Guess who teens say is their most important influence when it comes to sex? Their parents. Listen up. Teens want to know what you think, even if they don't act like it. Talk with your teens about sex, love, and values. Nationwide, one out of every three girls gets pregnant at least once by age 20. Make sure your daughter isn't one of them. Visit stayteen.org for special parent tips and more information on how you can prevent teen pregnancy. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Sea Alaska wants the federal government to spend some of its stimulus money thinning trees. The Southeast Regional Native Corporation has asked for close to $1 million to expand its own forest management program. Officials say the money could keep 40 rural residents on the job. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Logged forests grow back crowded, and that lengthens the time the next generation of trees take to reach commercial size. So foresters send crews into thick young stands to take out the smaller trees and prune lower limbs from what's left. That speeds the bigger trees' growth. Sea Alaska is already spending $1.5 million this year on silviculture. That's the term used for trimming, pruning, and other efforts to grow trees for commercial harvest. Executive Vice President Rick Harris says that's put 40 people to work in Hoonah, Craig, Klawock, Heidelberg, and Cake.
We've identified that additional silviculture opportunities will create more jobs in Southeast Alaska. And so we're encouraging the federal government to consider making funds available for additional silviculture work.
Sea Alaska's money will keep crews on the job into September. The corporation has applied for a federal stimulus grant for another $800,000 to $900,000 to continue the effort. Ron Wolf is the corporation's natural resources manager.
We have crews, we have contractors, everything is in place to keep these people working.
It's unclear when the corporation will get word on the grant. If it comes through, Wolf says Sea Alaska would use the stimulus money for trimming and pruning its own forests on Chichagof, Kuprinov, and Prince of Wales Islands. But it also thinks the Forest Service should use stimulus money to hire Sea Alaska crews to work on the government's own second growth.
The Tongass has a significant number of acres that have been even-aged harvested but have not been silviculturally managed.
The Forest Service has already gotten more than $30 million in stimulus money for Alaska projects. That includes trails, cabins, road repairs, and habitat improvements. There's at least one thinning project planned for an area north of Sitka. Agency spokesman Ray Massey says contracting is an open process and Sea Alaska is welcome to bid.
This Recovery Act money is not to hire more Forest Service employees and put them to work. It's to get money on the ground for people who need work. So when we advertise these types of situations, we really would like local contractors to do the work.
Sea Alaska is highlighting the jobs created by its forest thinning efforts, which have been going on for years. But officials say it's more than an employment and logging preparation program. Rosita Wuerl is vice chairwoman of the corporation's board of directors.
I think we've been diligent in terms of this kind of work, but also some of the other kind of scientific investigations. You know, what has been the impact of our current timber harvest on our land, on our wildlife? You know, we want people to know that our intent is to be good stewards of the land and that we've demonstrated this through, I think, significant expenditures of funds.
But not everyone agrees. Conservation groups and some village activists have criticized Sea Alaska's forestry practices over the years. They say clear cuts, also known as even-age harvesting, destroyed wildlife habitat and logging crews damaged salmon streams. The Southeast Alaska Conservation Council supports using stimulus money to repair that damage, but Conservation Director Buck Lindekugel says it's not the same thing as getting ready for the next round of logging.
Is silviculture restoration? I don't think it's quite the same thing, but you know, given the impacts that have already occurred on those lands, particularly their location right around some of these villages that depend so much on wild forest resources, anything that they do in the short term will be beneficial and provide local jobs.
Even with thinning and pruning, Sea Alaska is decades away from harvesting its second growth timber. That's one reason it's trying to acquire older, once-logged Tongass stands through its land selection process. Those forests are expected to be ready for harvest about when Sea Alaska's remaining first-growth stands run out. But that acquisition depends on legislation, which faces substantial opposition in Congress. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Juneau.
Lauren Sands is making a name for himself, at least in parts of Southeast Alaska. The Tlingit rapper played the popular Home Skillet Festival in Sitka recently, and now he has plans for a tour of Alaska, starting in the native villages where he grew up. KCAW's Shalice Haas sat down with hip-hop artist Half Smoked and brings us this profile.
On the weekends, I be kicking it with my friends, always blending in with the new trend. Me and my crew doing what we do.
Lauren Sands, a.k.a. Half Smoked, travels with a posse. He wears a sideways baseball cap and a tough guy expression. And after several years in the lower 48, he's learned how to look and sound like a mainstream hip-hop artist. But since returning to Sitka, the place of his birth, the 24-year-old rapper says his eyes have been opened to something bigger.
Down there, I was running around making club songs, doing shows, copying what you see on TV and what you hear on the radio is the popular stuff. But now, as I came home, I feel like I should touch the youth and make music for my native people.
Put your hands up, put your hands up, put your hands up, put your hands up. From Sitka all the way to Juneau, it's all about that Alaska flow. Uh-huh. Even down low to catch a kin, I'm a Tlingit and a ship she in. That's right, man.
My Half Smoked name came from my grandpa because I was one of the very few people in town that was half white growing up in a native village. Like a piece of fish, a half-smoked piece of fish. I'm half native and I'm half white. I'm not fully cooked.
Sands has the words native and white tattooed in big decorative letters on his forearms. Today, he embraces the full scope of his heritage. But he says it wasn't always that way. Growing up in the native communities of Angoon and Alkali Lake, San says it was difficult to fit in, and he wanted to be popular.
You weren't cool if you were going to, like, beating or if you were trying to learn the language. The kids that really got involved in stuff like that weren't the kids out hanging out with the popular kids, you know? I guess I did what I had to do to fit in, but now looking back, I wish I was more involved with it so I can relate it more in my music nowadays.
Sans works native cultural references and Tlingit words into many of his songs. He says he's been influenced by other native hip-hop artists, including big names like Lightfoot, and local musicians like his cousin David Johnson, known as Descript.
When they hear Tlingit, especially down south, most people don't know what it means. And I think if I can bring the Tlingit culture into my music and then bring a little bit of what I learned down south into my music and bring it all together, it can open up the eyes to the rest of the world that, you know, hey, we're here and we are good at making music too and we want to be heard.
That's right, Sicka. That's right, Juno. That's right, Haida. Showing native love, we in the club, on the mic, feeling nice. Do it big, native. Do it big. Do it big.
When Sans was 17, David Johnson bought him his first rhyming dictionary. He remembers spending hours turning his daily life into rhymed stories. He says his first rap...
It's just a lot of words rhyming. Didn't tell a story. It was something like... I'm 17, lean, mean, fighting machine, half smoked dark meat from French Street, something like that. It was real corny at the time.
But 70 songs and 7 years later, Sans's art has matured. He says he not only understands that rap needs to tell a story, but he sees the value of making personal music.
I'm really proud of my first verse on Get Mine. It's definitely one of my favorite songs because it's all me. It's 100% me. It goes... Living a crazy life, I gotta get paid. I never been afraid to stand up on stage. I blow up like a grenade, I'm sharp like a blade, strong like a hurricane. I've been through a lot of pain. What I feel in my heart is hard to contain. That's one of my favorite verses right there. Because I talk about how I'm very dedicated and even though I come from a small town, I'm not giving up, you know.
Sans has been back in Alaska for 6 months now, and he says he's here to stay. He's enrolled in an AmeriCorps program building affordable housing, and he'd like to work as a carpenter someday. But he isn't giving up hope of making it big as a hip-hop artist.
If I made it mainstream, that would be awesome. But I wouldn't be disappointed, even just being famous here in Alaska or in Sitka or Southeast. I'd be happy with that.
Living a crazy life, I gotta get paid. I never been afraid to stand up on stage. I blow up like a grenade, I'm sharp like a blade, strong like a hurricane.
In Sitka, I'm Shalice Haas.
What I feel in my heart is hard to contain. Staying dedicated to the game, that's my main thing. I gotta entertain, man, that's my domain.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Jesse Zink in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jay Marble in Craig, Emily Schwing and Shalice Haas in Sitka, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Ellen Lockyer reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.